Hello, my name is Chip Lang, and you're listening to Total EM. Once again, we have Mike Sharma for ATLS, and this time we're in Chapter 3, which is all about shock. And Mike, I think you had a good way of summarizing shock. Do you want to tell us what you think of it?
Yeah, I mean, you know, if you were to read this chapter, you might just be like, they're saying the same thing over and over again, but it's so important. Step one in managing shock is recognizing that the patient is in shock. And, you know, for people that are clearly in shock, it's not hard. The second step in managing shock is doing something. Try something. Give some sort of attempt to resuscitate the patient. This third step is there is no third step. You go back to the first step and you see, is the patient still in shock? And decide, what do you do next? If you think about it that way, shock is very easy. But when you start getting into the more complicated patients, the sicker patients, all the different kinds of shock that can happen in the very same patient, by the way, that's where it gets really interesting and really difficult.
And if there is one thing to take away from this, the absolute probably most important thing to understand is that in trauma patients, by far the most common and should be your first thought. Doesn't have to be your only thought. Like Mike said, there can be multiple forms of shock compounding into each other. But the most important, the most common in trauma is hypovolemia. What does that mean? Hemorrhaging. They're bleeding to death. And so if you have someone with a positive shock index, which we're going to talk about more here in just a second, but if they have a positive shock index or they're looking shocky, they're looking like crap, there's someone that you need to do something with because they are going to spiral down and die. First, think about hemorrhage. In the trauma patients, you need to consider and treat that first. Now, the others, like cardiogenic shock, which we don't see a ton directly in shock itself for trauma, but what we do see is next most commonly, I'd say, obstructive shock.
Right.
That is when you have like some sort of physical obstruction going on. In trauma, this would be like a tension pneumothorax or cardiac tamponade. These are the big things you have to think about there and you would have to address. Additionally, you know, there's septic shock, but that would be extremely rare when we're talking about trauma, unless this is like someone, I guess, who's like dying on the way of hospital from sepsis, and then the ambulance crashes, and now they're hypovolemic, or maybe they're in their POV and they crash. Like that one's pretty freaking unlikely in this case. Neurogenic, it's usually from some sort of spinal injury, which is in its own way kind of a little bit confusing and different, but ultimately, the biggest thing to think about, I would say, is hypovolemia. And then if you're still having someone who is in a shock state, next dive into obstructive, unless you have some reason to go a different direction. But those are the two biggest killers, which by far, hemorrhage is going to kill the most trauma patients.
Yeah, you know, and this is straight out of the red text. Again, we're going to be highlighting some of the red text from the ATLS manual because, again, our goal here is to help you for the ATLS test so you can pass and be certified. But then also, you know, it's red for a reason in this book, and the red is because it's really important in real life. And straight out of the red text, hemorrhage is the most common cause of shock and trauma patients. If that's the case, we should spend a lot of time in recognizing hemorrhage from all sources and treating it from all sources as well. We should be really good at that.
Keep in mind, this is not just hemorrhage as in someone's bleeding out externally. Yes, if you have an extremity wound, then slap that tourniquet on there if that's what's causing the massive hemorrhage. If you have a junctional bleed, good luck to start with because that's a little bit harder to control. But there are ways to help control junctional bleeding, and usually that's going to be direct pressure. Finally, if they're bleeding intra-abdominally or intrathoracic, or what you really hope doesn't happen is intracranial, because that's the hardest to do in the field or in a critical access environment or one where you just don't have the resources necessary. Most of these people, if they're going to bleed out, it's going to be externally, sometimes in junctions. And then when you're talking about in the thorax itself, like a hemothorax or an intraperitoneal bleed, or sometimes even retroperitoneal bleeds, but a little less common than the others. Like I said, this is one of those things that you have to be really thinking about because there are different ways to control each type of hemorrhage. Like I said, whether it's tourniquets, whether it's controlling that junctional bleed with direct pressure, or if it's going to be some sort of surgical management with these patients with other areas of injury, whether that's to the head, chest, or abdomen pelvis. whatever the point is, you're going to have to usually get some sort of involvement of a surgeon, because even if it's a severe extremity or junctional bleed, then this is going to be something that while you may be able to immediately control it, someone else is going to have to definitively manage it. And that is, I think, one of the biggest things is, once again, if you got someone who's in a shock state and you're in a setting where you do not have a surgeon readily available, you need to get that person into the correct place, or at least get them the correct disposition, even if you have a surgeon in the hospital.
Yeah, it's really important to identify that problem that you can't fix and call the person who can fix it. Chip, I'm thinking, you know, we've said the S word several times already. Have we even identified or defined, rather, what shock is? Have we talked about that yet?
No, I guess we should, huh?
Considering the chapter's about shock, we probably should define the word.
Well, I mean, go right ahead.
You got it. You know, so technically, what we're dealing with is a problem with the circulatory system that results in inadequate perfusion of the tissues, inadequate perfusion of the organs. Because guess what? Someone can bleed a lot. Someone can lose a limb. But if we can jump on whatever injury there was and stabilize it, put direct pressure or whatever, this person may never go into shock. So shock happens when you are having poor organ perfusion. And that's the key there. And there's a lot of different biomarkers and vital signs that we're going to get over the course of a patient's care. But in the end, these are just, and I've kind of hinted about this at previous podcasts, these are kind of poor substitutes to kind of some of the next level markers that we can be using to assess for perfusion. Because guess what? I can pump up someone's blood pressure really fast. I can increase your heart rate or decrease your heart rate with drugs very well, but that doesn't mean I'm perfusing anything. That doesn't mean that the blood is sending oxygen-rich hemoglobin to your brain, to your kidneys, to your lungs. When that's not happening, that's shock. And so today's chapter, we're going to go over shock. We're going to go over how to recognize it and treat it.
Keep in mind, there are going to be a lot of numbers coming your way, and we understand that, which is actually part of the reason why we're not going to mention a ton of numbers, because some of these are best seen in tables, which we're going to include in the show notes. So if you feel like we're glossing over certain sections, it's not because we don't care. It's not because we don't want to go over, we don't know it. It's because it can be very overwhelming in a podcast form. And so please, 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 like with all these other ones, check the show notes, because you're going to understand a little better. One thing I would like to mention just when we're talking about numbers real quick, because it can get overwhelming as far as like, how do you quickly identify someone where you need to be concerned about shock? Sometimes it's going to be really obvious. Your appearance will give you that idea. But one of my favorites that I use, and Mike, I don't know if you're using this at all, is the shock index. And I mentioned that briefly. Shock index is really straightforward, because shock index is basically heart rate and blood pressure. The easiest way to think about it is if your heart rate is greater than your systolic blood pressure. So for example, you have a person who has a heart rate of 110 and a systolic blood pressure of 100, that's a positive shock index. It's going to be greater than one. If you look at some of these studies, they'll say that, you know, up to 0.7 is reasonable. But really, if you have someone who has a shock index greater than one, I am very concerned about these people, because while they may not look terrible yet, they are most likely trending in a direction that I need to be concerned about. Now, I'm also not a big fan of systolic blood pressures, because they can be deceiving and they are not actually what most blood pressure cuffs, unless you're doing manual blood pressure cuffs, the number that you're getting. What you're actually getting in automatic blood pressure cuffs is your MAP. And so your MAP is going to be your more accurate one, but also it's a more accurate number for end organ perfusion. And so generally, in most people, we want a MAP over 65. In some situations, we may want a MAP higher than that, such as 80, which will depend some on the context.
Yeah, I think it's really important to not just look at a number and go, oh, well, that number is above whatever number that you don't like to see, and think, oh, this patient is fine. Because think of all the people that you've met in your ER or your urgent care clinic or your family practice clinic, and their blood pressure is 130, 140, 150 from the mildest of uncomfortable situations or stressful situations here. Contrast that with someone who was in a true trauma. Okay, they were in a bad car accident. They had a bad injury and their systolic blood pressure is 110. That's interesting. Why is that? Is it because they're just like a super cool cat and they're very, you know, okay with their injury? Or is this the first sign that someone is starting to go down a bad direction here? And, you know, if you ask anybody, hey, I got a patient with a blood pressure of 110. What do you think about that? You know, and the, you know, less seasoned clinician would go, I'm fine with that. The more seasoned clinician may go, well, that all depends. Tell me the rest of the story. What else is going on with this patient with a systolic blood pressure of 110? The number does not really tell the whole picture. And if you see that table, one of the tables that Chip is referring to, it talks about the classes of shock, which, you know, is nice, but in the end, it's not super, and this is kind of talked about in the text, it's not super important to identify, well, this patient is in, you know, class 3 shock, which defined as blah, blah, blah. And so we have to do this certain, you know, like very rigorous intervention because we've taken the time to identify class 3 shock. No, we have to kind of ballpark. There's a lot of Kentucky winded, as they say here. You know, we are not just following directions from a cookbook. We are chefs. We are having to put it all together, make adjustments on the fly, and end up with a good product.
God, I love that part where you're saying that we're not just following a cookbook, we're chefs, because we have to tailor care depending on the situation. I think that's one of the biggest things to talk about there. Mike, I think to help illustrate the point, let's talk about like two very different patients here. And I want you to tell me which one you're more concerned about.
Okay.
So let's say that we have a patient, elderly gentleman, who comes
I'm already
in,
concerned about this guy. He's elderly. I'm already concerned.
Yes.
go ahead. Sorry.
So, elderly gentleman, let's say his blood pressure is a systolic of 150, because we're going to stick with the shock index here for a second.
Okay.
So, his systolic is 150. His heart rate's 120. He's maybe like talking to you, but maybe not fully coherent. When you examine, when you're doing your quick primary assessment, you realize that he's a little cool to touch. You know, you can discount all these things like, oh, he was out in the cold and like maybe he's already got some Alzheimer's dementia going on. And maybe he's just a little anxious because he's confused about what's going on too. Versus, let's say, the middle-aged female, and this is not to stereotype at all, but the middle-aged female who is screaming, shouting, saying, I'm going to die, but then we'll stop and answer your questions for you. But let's say her heart rate is 150 and her systolic is 130, but she's still warm to touch. She's still answering questions appropriately. Which one are you more concerned about and why?
I'm way more concerned about the quiet patient that I can't kind of console. Like, is she, what you're describing in the second patient is kind of a consolable, distractible patient. It's almost like a kid. You know, like you've got a kid who is, you know, screaming their bloody fool head off in the ER, but you show them like a little, you know, Captain America figurine. I have a little Captain America, like, mini figurine on my backpack that I carry on me to the ER. And so if I can kind of wave this in front of a kid's face and the kid stops crying, kind of stares at my Captain America, then I'm less concerned about that child. You know, so that's kind of the same thing with this middle-aged person who's kind of acting like a, well, I won't say it, but, and I was going to say child and not the other thing, okay? But, you know, this person is very upset and is very stressed, and they have a great reason to be, because whatever they're experiencing is outside of their norm. I'm much less concerned about this middle-aged lady who, you know, all things being equal, has a much better circulatory system, much better mechanisms for compensation than an elderly gentleman who is tachycardic. Like, I start worrying about oldies when that heart rate comes up above 90. You know, because even though it's like, well, 90 is still considered a normal heart rate. Yeah, but where is he going to be in an hour? Why is it up that high right now? Because he's probably on a beta blocker, right? So why is it up in the 90s already? You know, I'm concerned about the old person. Before you told me anything, I'm all concerned about the old person.
Yeah, I probably should have led with the other one first. But well, and the reason why I want to mention him first is because he has technically a negative shock index. Right. But everything else in the story is concerning. And part of the reason why I wanted to give that negative shock index is exactly what you just mentioned, which is he's on a beta blocker most likely, or there's a good chance that a lot of people are going to be on beta blockers. And so you probably will never get that heart rate of 120, or maybe it's going to be really late disease where you're getting that 120. That's why he's also cool to the touch. Like, that's another red flag. If you have a person who's cool to the touch, they're clamping down, they're having cutaneous vasoconstriction, and I'm worried about that person too.
We mentioned on previous podcasts how we didn't talk to each other before this, so it's funny that we both came to this conclusion. We just kind of sidle up to the patient and take their radial pulse. And while we're palpating for the radial pulse, we're also kind of monitoring and checking, like, generally, what is their skin texture and turgor and coolness or warmth of the skin of the forearm, and then just talking to them. And talking to, you know, other people who do trauma for a living, you can get a lot before anyone has slapped on a pulse ox, before anyone has even started to inflate a BP cuff, just from that brief looking at a patient, kind of eyeballing them and going, uh-oh, this is a really old patient, this is a really young patient, this is a pregnant patient, this is a special population patient, basically, and I'm just touching them and talking to them. In 10 seconds, I'm getting a lot of information, and I'm already knowing which way I kind of want to go.
I'm actually going to give you a different case here, Mike. I want to throw another one at you because I think it helps illustrate an important point. So let's say you have a flight crew who comes to your hospital, and given you're in a community setting, so you're wondering why this helicopter is coming there, but they're forced to land at your facility because of weather. They were not able to go to their original destination. And they had a point of care hemoglobin because they've got some awesome point of care testing with them. And as they're coming into your emergency apartment, they're able to give you some labs and stuff like that right off the bat. But what you have in front of you is a patient with a significant extremity hemorrhage, like they've got an open femur fracture. There's some questionable arterial involvement. Blood is still seeping a little bit past the tourniquet. And so they said, well, the hemoglobin right now is a hemoglobin of 10. And this patient's heart rate is right around like 120. They're middle-aged. Their blood pressure is right around 100 systolic. You know, they're freaking out, man. So in some ways, kind of similar to that last one. But this is someone who, you know, they said, well, the hemoglobin's fine right now. And they got it shortly after the actual trauma occurred. Is this someone with what you have right now, information-wise, is this someone that you're going to start a massive transfusion protocol on? Why or why not?
You said this patient had an amputation. Is that correct?
Not an amputation, but a severe extremity hemorrhage with an open fracture and what appears to be a femoral artery bleed.
Yeah, I'm totally concerned about this patient, and there's a lot of reasons. So number one, again, reading right from the text here. So massive blood loss, big life-threatening exsanguinating hemorrhage may only produce a slight decrease in your initial H&H concentration. So hemoglobin is a concentration mathematically. That's what it is. It's the amount of hemoglobin per deciliter of blood. So guess what? If you all of a sudden lost, let's say, one-fifth, one-quarter of your blood volume, like right now, if I snap my finger and all of a sudden I just pulled X amount of blood volume out of you, and then I drew a hemoglobin of what was left, your hemoglobin's probably still fine, even though I just sucked a quarter of your life away. Because again, we're looking at a concentration. The concentration of what's left after the massive blood loss is the same right before the massive blood loss here. So yeah, I'm less concerned about hemoglobin. Do you know how many times I got a hemoglobin in Afghanistan? Zero. We didn't have any labs in Afghanistan. You know, we had people who had gunshot wounds or arms and legs, you know, shattered or just blown clear off their body. And there were no labs to be drawn out there. So, you know, it's fantastic that this, you know, air crew had access to labs. I'm more concerned about the tourniquet that was not a criticism to this fake air crew. So I'm not trying to offend any fake air crews out there, but this, you know, tourniquet that was applied and it's still seeping blood behind it. That tells me you need to turn that windlass a little bit tighter, or you need to put a second tourniquet right on top of that other one to get that bleeding to stop, because all we're seeing is the blood coming out of the patient. What we're not seeing is the amount of bleeding that's going on inside the patient right now. You know, they talk about four and the floor as far as places that people can lose blood. You can bleed plenty inside your body, even inside your extremities. Your legs can hold a lot of blood outside of the vasculature. So yeah, I'm very concerned about this patient who has, you know, a massive uncontrolled bleed from a, you know, large extremity. And yeah, I think I would go ahead and activate the MTP right there, because I know that this person's been losing blood this whole time. Wherever they've been flying from, they've been losing blood this whole time. And so they're going to need a lot more than just one or two units of blood. And so if they need, you know, 4 units right away, that's MTP criteria by ATLS, and we should go ahead and activate.
That is exactly what I was looking for. So let's talk about something that I personally find controversial, and I'm sure some of our listeners will feel the same way, but we have to talk about this a little bit because ATLS specifically brings this up. But what is going to be your initial fluid therapy for this patient?
Well, if you're trying to pass your ATLS test, then your initial fluid therapy is 1 liter of normal saline. And maybe you'd go lactated ringers. I think it also talks about how that's something you can use too. But basically they're saying, yeah, you're giving, and I think this is important to go over for the test. So what they recommend is 1 liter of crystalloid as an initial fluid challenge to someone who you think has, you know, potentially in hemorrhagic shock, or 20 cc's per kilo in a pediatric patient up to about 800 cc's of normal saline. So that is kind of the textbook answer. But I got to say, I'm sure the American College of Surgeons was kind of like, you know, kind of like squinting their eyes and kind of like holding their nose as they hit print on this 10th edition manual, because they have to know that that is really in flux right now, those recommendations.
This is just me hoping. The reason for doing the liter saline at first is because I think it makes it a little more permissible in your rule settings that either may not have blood products at all, because there are definitely those places that exist, as well as to help support your EMS agencies that almost guaranteed do not have blood products. There's few in the nation that really do, especially when we're talking about ground EMS. So I want to think that that's part of the reason why that's there, because it used to be 2 liters of saline was the original bolus for adults. And now we've cut that down to 1 liter. But my personal practice with trauma patients is I try to absolutely avoid crystalloids at all possible. The one time where I may give people crystalloids is going to be in conjunction with medications, basically. If that means to help deliver the tranexamic acid that they're going to need or the cefazolin that they're going to need for, you know, it's basically surgery prophylaxis and open fracture prophylaxis, you know, those types of things or other medication deliveries that I may need, like I'm fine with the normal saline being there because I don't really have an alternative. But I'm going to try and limit that as much as possible and focus in on the blood products.
That's really interesting to talk about. Yeah. The manual even mentions, you know, understand that when you hit, you know, in your EMR for your ER or whatever, you hit 1 liter normal saline IV, enter, right? You have to account for every other bit of normal saline that's already been administered. How much normal saline did the patient get on the EMS vehicle on the way in? How much are they going to get with their TXA or their antibiotics or whatever else they're getting? So, I mean, like, they're getting plenty of fluid. They're getting fluid challenged in other ways here. So that's interesting to kind of like look at that. Consider that maybe as their fluid challenge and see how they go from there. Yeah, I am kind of like cheating even less. It's almost like, you know, that joke about I can name a song in 5 seconds. Well, I can name a song in 4 seconds. I can name the song in 3 seconds. Yeah, it's like, you know, ATLS went from 2 liters to 1 liter. And now me, I'm like, well, I might just give 500 cc's or like something even smaller than that, because like I'm just trying to do a little fluid challenge and seeing what happens in conjunction with everything else they're already getting.
I think what Mike is bringing up is something that is reasonable. I'm not going to argue the point too much. I think Mike already knows I disagree with this, but I also probably work in a slightly different facility. I will only use crystalloids if I absolutely have to. In fact, and there's not a ton of literature to support this, but then I don't think there's a ton of literature that actually supports like giving crystalloids in trauma. But what I'm going to do is if I absolutely have to, if I have to do something before I get my blood products, because sometimes it happens, there's a delay in massive transfusion. We're getting better about it in my local place, but it's taking some time. And that is, I might give them a bit of a presser. And I do mean a tiny bit, but I'm going to be very cautious about that too. And I think my presser choice is going to be vasopressin based on the little bit of evidence that's out there. There, I said it.
I think it's great. And I think that is, you know, we mentioned about ATLS 10th edition is the floor, not the ceiling. I think it's really important to stand on ATLS 10th edition and look at what's going to be in the 11th edition and what's in the most current discussions and, you know, other papers out there right now. Because, yeah, are there roles for pressors in hemorrhagic shock? You know, I think that that is, I'd say, controversial still. Would you agree, Chip? Or do you think that it's pretty well settled? I think it's still controversial.
Oh, absolutely. Pressors in hemorrhagic shock is something that's highly, highly debated, as well as talking about, and this is not just like being debated in general. I mean, you ask five different trauma surgeons, you'll probably get five different answers. You'll get, I see this mostly in the Twitterverse because it's amazing the number of trauma surgeons that hang out in Twitter. But you'll see one person who says, yeah, like do vasopressin if you absolutely have to. You get the next guy who's like, I'm going to let that blood pressure ride as low as I possibly can until I can get blood products on board. And to give you an idea of how low, I mean, we're talking about systolics that are down in like 60s, if possible, and someone who's otherwise healthy and can support it. That scares the absolute bejesus out of me.
Yeah, it's terrifying.
It's terrifying because I'm thinking like, is that really a good idea for multiple reasons? One, you have very little give. When that person arrests, you're going to be fighting a huge uphill battle at that point.
Right.
It'll be a hypovolemic arrest. So most likely be a PEA arrest, which is not true PEA. And it'd be basically a profound shock, without a palpable pulse is really what that comes down to. Different story, separate topic. We'll have to cover that at a different time. As far as like when you have this patient, I get really nervous with that low of a number, but also think about their end organ perfusion. They're not perfusing anything worthwhile, most likely. And that's something else that I am really hesitant on. So I'd like to get something in their system, but that's why I said I might lean a little more towards the pressor side. And if I'm talking about like, if we really have to give fluids, I even think 250 of saline may be almost too much. I think it's kind of one of those, it's what your environment is and what you have on you.
This will be settled, I think, somewhere after COVID is fixed. You know, so like, this is kind of a future topic to be settled here. I think that right now what's important for our listeners is the textbook says 1 liter. The textbook also says account for all the other ways this patient is getting saline. So if you kind of like read between the lines, what I like to do as far as I like to understand intent and not the letter of the law, I think the intent from the book may be saying, yeah, we're saying give the patient a liter of normal saline. At the same time, you know, if they're already getting normal saline in other places, you don't necessarily have to order a liter, you know? So I think that's a good way to look at it without getting too far into the weeds for our trauma people that are still being introduced to the science here.
I like that a lot. Let's move on to the next part of that. What ratios do you do massive transfusion protocol on? Not at all controversial. This is actually, I think, something that the literature has done a better job on recently. Really, I think what has held true and what is probably the most widely accepted, and Mike, maybe you've got something different, but I think generally it is a 1-to-1-to-1 ratio because we're trying to imitate whole blood. So basically, 1 unit of packed red blood cells, 1 unit of plasma, 1 unit of platelets. Now, if you are in a location like I am, you actually get a 6-pack of platelets. It takes forever to prepare, but platelets are probably my lowest priority. But I just understand that when the platelets do come, that's equivalent to 6 units of plasma and 6 units of packed red blood cells. So I'm trying to keep that balance going on. And unless this patient is really unstable or if we're having issues with significant delays in transfer, they will most likely not get the platelets from us. But I'm going to give the platelets whenever possible. But here's my other question with this, Mike. Mm-hmm. If you say you have all your blood products available to you at the same time, you don't have whole blood, but you have all three. You have platelets, you have plasma, you have packed red blood cells. They're all available at the same time. What are you going to give first and why?
I'm giving the PRBCs first. If we're talking about shock, and we are, then the idea is shock is a problem with perfusion, and perfusion is a problem with an end organ not getting enough oxygen. We get oxygen to end organs by delivering them with hemoglobin. And so I want to start with the PRBCs, but as is repeated so often in this textbook, we're doing something and then we're reassessing. Okay, how is that patient responding to my, you know, one unit or whatever unit PRBCs challenge in a way? Because, you know, like we think about like, oh, I gave this person PRBCs and I fixed them. No, this is still kind of a challenge. It's a dance here. And so if this person, there's different categories of responsiveness that we can kind of get into later on here as far as how well someone responds to your initial treatment here. But if this person like transiently responds or even doesn't respond at all, then I'm quickly reaching for the other stuff. And here's why. You know, we think about, okay, shock, and we're trying to get oxygen to somebody here. But if you figure someone's bleeding on the inside, I mean, that's all these patients are dying from blood loss until I prove that they're not dying from blood loss. Then what's happening is, as the person is trying to clot off and trying to stop that bleeding themselves, their coagulation factors and their platelets are being consumed. These are finite resources in the body. And so as the person bleeds, the body is trying to throw these clotting factors and platelets into the gap to try to stop the bleeding. Well, once you use them, they're used up. And so if this person is still having bleeding, and how do I know they're still bleeding? Because they don't respond to the PRBCs, or because they respond a little bit and then they start continuing to go down the track here of no return, then that's my clue to say, aha, this person is not responding well. There's still a bleed going on. Their clotting factors and their platelets are still being used up. And so I need to get in there and help the body out with some additional clotting factors and platelets. How'd I do?
Good. I think that's probably the most commonly perceived as giving the packed red blood cells first. I think part of that is because that's what's been ingrained in us. I'm sure probably the military is probably the same way, where you most likely kind of learn that from first, I would assume. But I would argue a slightly different thing, and this is because of some newer evidence that has come up. And I would actually give plasma first.
That's where I thought you were going to go. Yeah, go ahead.
Here's my thought process behind that. If you have someone in shock, is it really the fact that they lack oxygen carrying capacity, or is it because their overall volume down?
Right.
And if their overall volume down, then the plasma is actually going to help promote the most volume versus the packed red blood cells will. So I'm going to pull out the plasma first and infuse it first. Really, in my real life scenario, I'm going to try and have two different lines that are running both at the same time. That's cheating. So if I have to pull one, it's going to be plasma first. And I'm going to try and get packed red blood cells shortly behind it. But you also have to think about most places that have packed red blood cells. Their oxygen carrying capacity of the hemoglobin, as that hemoglobin itself degrades, which doesn't take very long at all, is actually less and less beneficial for that role. So really, packed red blood cells, depending on your setting and where you're at and how your facility decides to keep packed red blood cells for massive transfusion, even if they do have a massive transfusion protocol, which a lot of places still don't, I think that's kind of a little bit scary. I can understand if you don't have blood products to start with why you wouldn't, but I would try and do plasma first. But the problem is that most plasma is frozen. We've only recently started ourselves carrying a couple of units of liquid plasma on hand. And then when we activate our massive transfusion protocol, we're supposed to get our fresh frozen plasma to start being thawed out. And so in that interim period, while we're waiting for the FFP, our liquid plasma is infusing. When it's done, we start giving packed red blood cells. And then eventually someone will come with platelets, maybe, maybe not. But we're going to try and stick with that kind of interval. At least that's my personal preference. And that's based on what literature I've been looking at.
I think that's really good thinking. And, you know, the science is still not settled here. You know, I think that, you know, I'm not saying you're wrong and I'm right. I'm not saying that I'm whatever the other permutation is of that, you know, what I just said there, it was already gone after I said it. But basically, you know, I think that from our perspective right here, trying to help folks with ATLS, I think that these are good things to look towards for the future and go, hey, you know, is the first thing we reach for in the future for 11th edition going to be a liter of normal saline? Gosh, I hope not.
And this is Mike's very nice way of telling me get back on the damn track and focus on what we're actually supposed to be talking about with ATLS. But I think if we're going to talk about blood, we have to talk about these things.
Oh, we have to. I totally agree.
Yeah, these are some of the controversial things that come up and some of the things that, like you said, the science is still out there and that's totally okay. We're figuring out more and more each day and that's fine. It's good that Mike and I have these differences in opinion, I believe, because it helps show two different perspectives, which is totally fine. I think in the end, I will be right.
A safe assumption. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think it's going to be really interesting to see what develops over time. You know what else is interesting and has changed over time?
What?
Tranexamic acid.
Ah,
TXA.
You know what?
Oh, look at that transition.
That was pretty brilliant. I like that a lot. I want to get to that controversial thing after I address another controversial thing, if it's okay.
Absolutely.
Okay. So, quick tee off of what Chip said there. This is kind of classically what happens, right? You go to a course or you go to a formal school environment and you learn a thing and you go, cool, I understand that thing. And so you go to your work and you try to do the thing you just learned about. And then everyone around you is like, why are you doing that? You know, because either they didn't go to the course or they've already gone to that course and they've gone to a bunch of other courses after you. So I don't think you get freaked out. I don't think you get super concerned by us telling you, hey, 10th edition is already almost in the rearview mirror. I think, again, this is the common operating language that everyone works in. And if you do something that's supported by 10th edition, then I think it is medical legally defensible. And I mean, that's like kind of the worst reason to do something on somebody is it's medically legally defensible. But still, I think that if you do something based on 10th edition instructions, someone will go, oh, well, at least I know why they did that. I think it's great we're talking about it. At the same time, I think it's important that we have this discussion so that people understand what's out there and why people are going to give them the side eye if they do certain things that, well, it says in 10th edition to do this. Yeah, well, we're already moving towards the 11th edition, you know, in a lot of ways. The controversy I want to go over is this.
Mike, I would totally agree with you on that about, you know, I think one of the things that people sometimes forget, and I think this is something that happens across the board, not just like PAs, MPs, RNs, paramedics, physicians, it doesn't matter. You have to have local buy-in for what you do.
Yes.
You will realize, depending on what course you take, or what you learn, or what you read literature-wise, is that sometimes there may be certain reasons, and I'm not saying they're going to be good or bad, but there are going to be certain reasons why some things occur in a local area that is going to be different for your things that you learned in your course. One common one that is totally off trauma for a second, I'm just going to bring up really, really quick, and then Mike will get back to his stuff. But Tamsulosin or Flomax,
oh my gosh,
being used with kidney stones is something that has come up more and more about maybe it's not actually beneficial in the vast majority of cases. However, when I brought this up to my local urologist, for which there are three, and I discussed this with him, I said, hey, this is what the literature shows on our side. Is this okay if we start, you know, ignoring this and only giving it in certain circumstances? They said, actually, we'd prefer you not. And I said, okay, I'd be happy to know why. And they said, well, when we do stents, the stents work better when we give them with Tamsulosin. Our own evidence and our own experience shows that we still need it. So while you may not give Tamsulosin in the emergency department, we're going to want it and we're going to start prescribing it when they see us. And unfortunately, that may sometimes put them behind on their treatment. So they want us to still do it for basically all stones because it helps on the back end for them.
That's fascinating you mentioned that. And I've had the same Tamsulosin thoughts. You know, I thought you were going to go with PO contrast and CT of anatomy and pelvis, but that's something entirely different here.
Oh God, that's a whole bigger, no, that was a bigger one to unpack. I went with Tamsulosin, that's easy.
Yeah, and so I did the same sort of thing. I read the same studies you saw, and I go, okay, I guess I'm not using Tamsulosin with a lot of people anymore here. But you know what? We're looking at the problem with emergency medicine glasses on, right? Because what do we care about? We care about, can this person be dispoed home for a trial of expulsive therapy, or does this person need to be admitted to the hospital? That's all we care about in emergency medicine, right? We don't necessarily care as much about packaging this patient for the urologist. That's the urologist's problem, right? But it's fascinating to understand that, hey, the urologist gets a benefit from this patient being on Tamsulosin. And so if this person's blood pressure is not brittle, if there's no contraindications to putting someone on Tamsulosin, then like, yeah, maybe I do go ahead and do that, even though if you talk to somebody who just got back from an emergency medicine course, they might go, why are you doing that? You know, but I think I see more folks putting people on Tamsulosin than not, regardless of stone caliber.
All right, fair enough. And since we went totally off base, I'll let you go back onto what you're talking about.
Sure. So the next controversy I want to go over is this. You know, there's the first step treating shock is recognizing the person's in shock. Okay, well, how do I do that? Well, it naturally follows that I have to examine the patient. Okay. And so you read the ATLS manual, it goes, okay, the first step of examining a patient who may be in shock is assessing their airway and their breathing. And it's like, wait a minute, we just talked about how hemorrhage is the most common cause of shock and trauma patients, and I'm going to pick up the airway and breathing sign? You know, like, I don't understand it. You know, I think, again, this is a place where we should read between the lines, and we should kind of understand what the surgeons here are trying to say. And the wording is adequate ventilation and oxygenation. It does not say sedate, paralyze, and intubate this patient. You know, we know that we can get adequate ventilation and oxygenation sometimes with bag valve masking. You know, so before you get prepared to drop the tube and do all these things, if this is a trauma patient, again, this patient is bleeding out in front of me until I prove they are not doing that. So yeah, I'm doing a quick A and B assessment, and my quick treatment is, hey, start bagging this patient. And I'm moving on to C right away here, okay? It takes about 2 to 5 minutes to bleed out from a massive exsanguinating wound here. And unless this patient was standing in your ER when they were shot or when they lost their extremity, they're already on the clock. You know, so I think it's great that airway and breathing is there for this textbook because it's important to be systematic. You know, I think it's important that every patient you see, you go down the same A, B, C, D, E, but understand in a trauma patient, and this is ATLS after all here, that A and B, it's pretty quick and you need to address C very quickly. A lot of people are going towards the CABs instead of the ABCs. And we hinted at that at previous podcasts as well.
And I'm going to add one more thing before we go back to TXA. And that's another exam portion, because it kind of ties in. And that is, we want to expose these people, right? That's part of the ABCDE is exposure and environment. But keep in mind that we're trying to prevent hypothermia, and this ties in very nicely with shock because hypothermia is part of the lethal triad, the other two being coagulopathy and metabolic acidosis, which is why another reason why I don't like crystalloids is because they can contribute to the metabolic acidosis and the coagulopathy as well as the hypothermia, because unless you warm these fluids, and unless they are pH stable, which they usually aren't, they're going to be somewhat acidic. And unless they somehow had blood products, wait, that'd be then warmed blood products. Never mind. That makes sense now. So, but when you're giving crystalloids, all you're doing is thinning out the actual blood that's still there. It's usually going to be not heated, not warmed up. And like I said, you're going to have some acidosis component. You're fulfilling all three parts of the lethal triad of trauma. And that gets before you have the patient who's naked, laying out in an environment that's cold, like we've talked about before, and in which case Iraq is probably a better place to be because then, you know, they're nice and warm most of the time. But like I said, I think that's one of the things that we need to cover really quickly is just that lethal triad of trauma comes up once again with shock.
Yeah, that's, I like that a lot. You know, we used to be very aggressive with exposing patients in a combat theater. And I think it has its place. You know, I mean, like, it's one of those things. If you have a hammer, everything's like a nail. If you're holding a pair of trauma shears and you were told to expose the patient, guess what's coming off? All them clothes are coming off, you know? And so that was one of the things that as a trauma team leader, we tried to be a little more judicious about. How much am I cutting off this patient? Because guess what? Once I cut off this person's shirt or pants, they're not a shirt or pants anymore, okay? I can't use them to cover the patient anymore. I've got to cover up some other way here. And so that's a good thing that the trauma team leader can do, that quick sidling up to the patient, doing a quick assessment and going, yep, all these clothes are coming off, or, hey, we can take it a little bit slower because why? We have to balance the coagulopathy and the blood loss with the potential for hypothermia, which can cascade into all these other bad things.
Let's go now, I think, since we've delayed enough, our TXA point. So anytime, and this is the way I think about it, and when we talk about the CRASH II study, I think it ties in nicely too. But anytime that I'm going to start massive transfusion, or basically if these people are going to be sick enough that they get blood products, as long as it's within 3 hours of the event of trauma, I'm going to give them tranexamic acid or TXA. And how do you give this? Is something that is kind of interesting. So basically, we will give 1 gram over 10 minutes, which can be like a slow push. You can put in a small bag to mix it in, just let it drip in. If you talk to the people who actually did the CRASH II trial, they just kind of did a very slow push in. So they didn't put them on an infusion pump, but they just, you know, gave it. They just let it flow in. And then you would give a follow-up gram over the next 8 hours. Now, given if you're not in the facility, we're going to give definitive care, you're probably not going to do that 8 hours bit. You're going to leave that up to the next group, which is totally fine. They've got bigger things to deal with in the transport time. And so that's kind of my big thing about TXA is you just have to remember to give it within 3 hours, and it's going to be 1 gram, ideally over 10 minutes. I think that's how the prior test question will be. The 1 gram given over the next 8 hours is less important, but still good to know.
So you're saying you're giving it IV, right? So what about these patients who you just can't get a line on? I mean, these are patients who have, you know, probably lost blood into themselves or onto the floor wherever they got injured, and now they got flat veins. So how are we going to handle that?
Wait, do I see another transition? Vascular access? Why, yes.
I tried to make that smooth, but that was a little bit too smooth, I think.
Well, see, here's the thing. Normally, I'd say that if I have a difficult IV, I'm going to reach for the ultrasound.
Of course you would say that.
Honestly, though, and this is recorded, so you can say that Chip said you didn't have to do this first, but if they're really sick, if they are truly in shock, I'm not going to worry about getting the IV first. You know why?
Go ahead.
It's drill, baby, drill time. I am going to get some IOs. If I have to, I'll put bilateral humeral IOs. In fact, I did that just the other day.
Wow.
Because I am not going to waste time on IV access until we get that person pumped up a lot of times. So if we can get that volume built back up again, you'll notice that those veins start becoming a lot easier to see, in which case, yes, then you can go back and can transition to your vascular access. Now, something that you may ask yourself here, and this is something that I can include as a graph as well, is, what if you're having a hard time? Why don't you just put a triple lumen central line in? Because, you know, they might need a central line later anyway. So why not just go ahead and put a triple lumen? You can diffuse all sorts of stuff through it, right?
That's fast too, by the way. That didn't take long at all.
Yeah. It doesn't take long to perform, you know, a triple lumen central line, and the infusion rates are, the infusion rates are crap. Right. When it comes to blood products or trying to get any real volume built up. So that's, again, why I like the humeral IOs, because I can push a lot of volume through. All I have to do is get bone, and, you know, I just want to make sure it's good intact bone and that I try and go as proximal as possible. That's why I like the humerus. You'll actually be able to infuse more through the humerus than you will be able to infuse through like a proximal tibial. But there are lots of great options here. But if you are going to do a central line, say for whatever reason, you feel like you have to get a central line. Maybe this person's veins are shot at baseline. You know, they're maybe an IV drug user or history of IV drug use, and you are, you know, they're really volume down, even with despite your best efforts. Then I'd probably get an introducer sheath or a cordis central line in, because that I can put some real volume behind. But again, they have to have decent vessels to get something that big in, which is why I go back to the IO once again.
Yeah, we're just trying to temporize things here, right? You know, this person's not going to have an IO in for their entire hospital course. I'm just trying to make the next step easier. And so, yeah, I'll put the IO in, I'll inflate their veins a little bit, and then we can put in those awesome bilateral 18-gauge IVs into both AC, you know, fosse, and then they're set, you know? We just want to get to that point. And that's way easier, and it does not require a clinician to do that. You know, I mean, you know, you're doing a central line. How long does that take you out of play as far as the rest of the department goes? Are you really able to be a trauma team leader when you should be rightfully really paying attention to how that central line's going in so that you're not causing an infection? Oh, which, by the way, is part of that lethal triad of trauma, you know, going into acidosis from infection, right? So, you know, why am I going to take myself out of the trauma team leader position for that long when I can just go zzz, zzz, or I can have someone else go zzz, zzz, and they've got access and I can still have that. I've got that still that perspective. I'm standing a step back from the patient and seeing the whole thing instead of being my nose in the patient doing something that requires my full attention.
I completely agree with you. I think those are good points to have. And especially when you're talking about like the facilities that most people who are going to actually use the ATLS are going to be at, then yeah, you're probably going to have yourself as the team leader, and you may not have someone else who can really take on that role. And so you need to be able to delegate off as much as possible. And that central line will really tie you up for a while, unless you're doing a crash central line, in which case that's not sterile, which means that someone else is going to have to change it out, and also still increases their rate for infection.
Yeah, I think there's too many good reasons to do an IO and too few reasons to not put an IO in. Does the guy not have bones? No, he does. Okay, good. Then go and put an IO in, and then you're done. You've got access.
All right. Well, I think we have gone through quite a bit, and once again, we're rounding about an hour. That's just how we roll with these, because there's so much content. And to be fair, Shock, I'm actually impressed that we have kept it down to this point. But Mike, are we forgetting anything really pressing that is not better explained maybe in a chart form or something else that we really need to hit?
You know, you could spend a weekend conference talking about shock and really delving into the different aspects of shock and the current controversies in shock. So, you know, I don't think this is the place for further controversy. We've already hit all the controversial buttons already, you know? So I think there's a lot of good things to mull over, to kind of look at a table, look at a graphic, and really kind of like chew the cut on shock on. And we're going to have tables in the show notes. It's important because I think it's important to kind of eyeball what class of shock someone might be in. And, you know, we didn't really talk about like the things that people who are listening to this program probably were expecting us to talk about more, as far as we did kind of hit it, but like pulse, blood pressure, pulse pressure, a lot of things that are kind of commonly thought of as far as shock and shock indicators. I think that these are all, again, poor man's and poor woman's substitutes for what's really going on in the body. There's other things like base deficit, which is a new thing in the 10th edition that I think is very interesting as far as how is someone doing as far as shock goes? Are they in shock? But if we're talking about the initial reception and stabilization of shock patients, again, there is very little that beats walking up to the patient and saying, "Hey, how you doing?" and putting a hand on their arm and just kind of assessing their skin, assessing their pulse, their radio pulse, and making some first calls just from that assessment, that brief seconds-long assessment.
Yeah, and this is, again, a very hard chapter to summarize just because of the volume of content here and the controversies that are riddled throughout this entire thing, for which if you have any concerns about any of the controversial things, you could go and talk to Mike at Facebook, and you can find him at... No.
Oh, God. No. I'm not on Twitter either, so don't even try that.
But really, if you want to also weigh in, I think this is something that really the discussion could keep going on here. Maybe that's something we'll have to revisit are some of the controversies and build off of that some more. Maybe that's something else we could do. But we'd love to hear your feedback in the show notes, which you can go to totallym.org and be able to go to the ATLS chapters and give us that feedback in the comment section. But yeah, I think, Mike, that we have done about all we possibly can without becoming too overwhelming.
I think that in the end, we end where we began. The first step in managing shock is recognizing the person's actually in shock. And that's harder than it sounds like, especially in our special populations, our oldies, our athletes, people on certain medications. The second step in managing shock is taking a stab at why they might be in shock. Again, the most common reason is hemorrhagic, and your trauma patients are in hemorrhagic shock until you prove they're not, and you make a treatment, you make a call, you do something, do some sort of intervention here. The third step is go back to the first step. Is this patient still in shock, and what do I do now? The responsiveness to your first attempts at treatment will determine your next attempt at treatment.
All right. I love the summary. Mike, will you give us the tagline, please?
I will. Here's the tagline. Until next time, continue to provide total care everywhere.